I know that something like 40% of cabinet ministers, provincially and federally, so roughly the same, are landlords too, or invested in housing in somewhat. And I was that always the case, that you'd have like a cabinet minister who has this really important job and on the side they're a landlord?
What do we want the housing system to look like? Like what at the end of the day is the sort of promised land of all of this?
Hi, and welcome to The Missing Middle. I'm Kara Stern.
And I'm Mike Moffitt.
And today we're going to be talking about investors and renters.
But before we get started, don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you.
Mike, recently you tweeted that the first paradox of housing is that everyone wants rental options, but nobody wants landlords. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, I think, controversial observation, but it's absolutely true that, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, investors shouldn't own homes, corporations shouldn't own homes, REITs shouldn't own homes. But at the same time, we also, or at least most of us, want to have renters have lots of rental options. So you get into this weird dynamic where, you know, most of us want renters to have, you know, a wealth of rental options, but nobody actually wants landlords. And it makes for a strange conversation where, again, we have this bit of a disconnect. And I find so much of our discourse, particularly those of us who are more progressive minded, and I count myself among it, we tend to look at this issue through the lens of investors. I think we should be looking at this through the lens of renters and the options that they have. This is a point that Jennifer Bradshaw made recently on Twitter, and I think it's a really good one. And I think we actually have a more robust conversation if we center, you know, the rental dynamic from the perspective of the renter.
What does it mean to do that?
Well, I think if we do that, you have to then kind of think through what options do they have, right? Because if you do it through investors, it's really easy for, again, those of us on the left, center left, or even center to say investors bad, right? Or to say rich Gen Xers who read Rich Dad, Poor Dad in the late 90s and are now buying up all this real estate, they're bad. We got to get rid of both of those. That's an easy conversation to have, right? A harder conversation to have is through the renter's point of view, where we go, okay, well, should people be allowed to rent homes? And what are the conditions that they should be able to do so? You know, who should be the landlord? What should the sort of regulatory apparatus be? And it's just it's a different conversation, and I think a more pragmatic one, that it gets us out of this kind of mindset where we're just like this bad, this bad, this bad, and forces us to make some, you know, practical decisions.
The thing is that it used to be that people would buy homes to live in was more common. I know that one of the reasons we have a housing crisis, there are many reasons. And obviously, we always talk about how supply is probably the biggest reason. If you have enough supply, it doesn't matter who owns it. However, it didn't seem to be that people thought of it as a investment, and certainly not a get-rich-quick investment the way people do now. And so I've always heard that one of the big changes that has led to the housing crisis has been that financialization aspect. So that's why people, I think, well, if we can get people out of thinking of it as an investment and thinking of it as a way to get rich quick, then we would actually fix and get back to a time when, like, there used to be enough homes for people and there used to be enough rentals that they were, like, pretty affordable.
My question to those folks, when was that time?
It was around 2016, where you would see, like, the year-to-year increase of what the available rentals are go up significantly, and it just got worse and worse after that.
Yeah, but you answered an entirely different question there. The question you answered there is, when did prices go up? My question was more, when did people start thinking about housing, you know, owning secondary properties as an investment?
Was it with the interest rates going down to almost nothing?
Well, I would suggest that this is a much older problem. You know, remember that 80s movie, Glengarry Glen Ross?
I definitely mean,
the
don't.
Only thing that you've seen it, or at least seen the memes of it. It's where Alec Baldwin comes into a real estate office and says, like, always be closing. If you haven't seen that speech, go to YouTube, watch it. Maybe not have kids around. The language isn't.
Do you know that line? I did not even know that line was from a movie.
There you go. There you go. And it's a famous speech. But if we go back even further, President Truman's first presidential address as president in 1946 was about real estate speculation. So this is not a new issue. This, you know, can manifest itself different ways. But, you know, every generation kind of, you know, thinks they invented this problem. And trust me, as somebody who grew up in the 1980s, the idea that, real estate speculation is somehow younger than the cell phone or the smartphone is ahistorical. Now, it may have gotten worse. And I do think there are sort of periods of things getting worse and better. Absolutely. But, people speculating on real estate, you know, goes back hundreds and hundreds of years.
But if it became worse, isn't that what they're trying to correct for when people are talking about this? When you hear politicians talking about it, they're trying to correct for where it became so common that people, like everyday people, own multiple properties, which I don't know if that was the case back then as much.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. I'm not sure that we necessarily have evidence of that. But my point is, in particular, I'm going to pick on academics. This is where academics, I think, are completely ridiculous on this issue. So we have schools massively increasing enrollment. So we have these institutions of higher education massively increasing enrollment, building like maybe 3 residence spaces in all of Canada. And then academics wonder why investors are buying up single family homes and renting them to students. Like, what did you think was going to happen? You know, again, I posted a meme just the other day about, like, you know, we're all looking for the guy who did this, right? So yes, absolutely. We do see investors in recent times buying up single family homes and renting them to students. What did we think was going to happen when we bring in 1 million international students and create absolutely nowhere for them to live?
Was it always the case that you had politicians who were also landlords? Like, I know that something like 40% of cabinet ministers provincially and federally, so roughly the same, are landlords too, or invested in housing in somewhat. And I was that always the case that you'd have like a cabinet minister who has this really important job and on the side they're a landlord?
Okay, so this is actually a really interesting question around unintended consequences. So about 20 years ago, the federal government made some changes around conflict of interest, and it made it harder for cabinet ministers and other political officials to own, stocks and companies and things like that, right? Because you're like, okay, if I'm regulating oil and gas companies, I probably shouldn't be owning stocks in them, because we see what happens in the United States when groups do. One thing that they didn't include on that list is real estate. So what happened was we had a bunch of politicians and other people caught up by conflict of interest payment. Go, okay, well, I can't own stocks and other things unless I put them in a blind trust. But there's no rules around me not owning secondary properties. So it's actually due to us getting tough, us as a country getting tough on conflict of interest rules that, you know, the federal government didn't legislate in real estate in this. So people are going, okay, well, I can't invest in these other things. I'm going to go invest in real estate. And it just so happened to happen at a time when real estate prices were going up anyway, and it's already an attractive investment. So it's one of those things where it's like, be careful what you wish for. It's like, okay, we don't want politicians investing in stock. they're going to find something else to invest in. And unfortunately, that's, you know, not a great look right now.
It wasn't a great look when we had a housing minister who had been buying properties even while he was on that portfolio, because as someone who was watching it, I was like, whoa, I don't know how I can expect that you're going to fix it. If you don't even have confidence, you're going to fix the situation. And you're so confident that it won't be fixed, that it's going to be a worthwhile investment. Like, it's not a great look, and it doesn't give confidence to the rest of us. If so many of them are invested, including the finance minister owns multiple properties, and I believe owns properties outside of Canada too. So I don't, that's why I'm like, well, they're not going to really fully ban foreign buyers, because I mean, she is one of them. Do you think we'll actually see any changes at any time on this?
I actually don't think that's the motivating factor, to be quite honest. I think what's a bigger factor is public opinion, right? And personal opinions as well. Like, I don't think, you know, Premier Ford, for instance, is banning fourplexes because he has stock in triplex companies and, you know, three is good, four is bad, things like that. So I actually don't think it really makes that much of a difference, but the optics aren't great. And I think we can all admit that. And you do, I do think we should be looking at conflict of interest rules around that. You know, maybe this is a loophole we should probably address, because even if it's not affecting decision making, the optics aren't great. But I'm going to ask a question of you, that who should own rental properties? So if we decide, okay, it's not cabinet ministers and things like that, like, who would you like to see owning these?
Yeah, or should nobody? Don't want to be paying several thousand dollars a month to the housing minister. Like, that is, would be, make me so mad every time I wrote that rent check. But yeah, I know you posted this on Twitter recently asking people what they thought, and whether, like, people don't like small time landlords, people don't want big landlords, people don't want government housing, so no one wants any landlords. It's a tough thing in the sense that, like, I intentionally would never pick somewhere that's owned by anything other than a purpose-built rental. So I guess I want corporations to own rental properties. And I would only say that because I would not want to live somewhere where it's dependent on someone who maybe he doesn't even know the rules. At least that purpose-built rental, there's a good chance they'll know the rules. There's a good chance they have someone living there or willing to respond within hours when there's an issue, not respond, you know, in a week, a month, however long it takes, you know, grandma to answer, to call up a plumber to come over there. Like, and it's stable, but also we don't want so much concentration of power. So I don't know the answer to that. Like, what do you think would be the best for society?
Well, I think the important thing is that we're actually having this conversation, because it shows how much changing the framing really changes our thinking about this. Right. So I think we all sort of understand conceptually that somebody needs to own a rental apartment building, right? Like a high rise, you know, obviously somebody's going to own that. But what about more ground oriented homes? So single detached, semi-detached, even, you know, like townhouses and things like that. So, you know, 38.7% said no to investors. And we can interpret that a couple different ways. That could mean, like, literally people just shouldn't be allowed to rent these property types. Period. Okay, I'm going to disagree with that. I think if somebody wants to live in a townhouse or a single detached home and would prefer to rent, I think they should be allowed to do that. So I would disagree with that. The other interpretation is, well, these things should only be owned by the government and not-for-profits, so on. My response to that would be, okay, good luck with that. I don't think we're getting there anytime soon, but I can, you know, I do think we need more of those, and I'm not suggesting we don't, but, you know, to get to 100% of our rental, our ground level rental stock being owned by the government or co-ops or not-for-profits, I don't see that as being particularly realistic. So then you're basically left with three options. And I would say about 60% of people said that, no, it actually makes sense for people to be able to rent this and for the private sector to be owners. Now, 37.6% said either is fine. It could be a big corporation, small corporation, mom and pop. They don't really care. The next tranche is 16.6% said they're not comfortable with the large corporations and the REITs, but mom and pop investors should be okay. So if a group of rich dentists want to get together and buy a few homes and rent them out to people, we're okay with that. Only 7% of the 100% said that, no, actually, we're not comfortable with mom and pop investors, and we don't really like the rich dad, poor dad, Gen X investors. We want to have that more professional ownership that, that you describe, owning these things. So that could be either a larger corporation or a REIT, which is just a large corporation structured differently for tax reasons. Owning this thing. So there is a real divide here that I think we don't often talk about. Again, when we have the conversation that puts the, you know, investors first and look at everything from the investor's perspective, rather than focusing the conversation or centering the conversation around renters.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do think that it's like something that seems wrong about getting people buying all these low rises. Like, I know that if people want to live in low rises and someone needs to be the landlord, but then I often think about all the families who are renting these at like very expensive prices in a lot of places. And they would normally, like if this was 10 years ago, they would have been able to buy that no problem, like with the same income that they're now renting it. So that's where it kind of gets icky, because you're like, they're kind of taking them away from the people who otherwise could own them. And actually, for most people, would prefer to own them. Not everyone. There's cases for renting, but I think most people still would like to own a home. So that's like, I don't know how you get away from that kind of ickiness of that.
Well, I think what we need to do is look at like what do we want the housing system to look like? Like what at the end of the day is the sort of promised land of all of this?
I guess the end of the day is enough supply that you can choose to buy, you can choose to rent, whatever you want. That's you have the option and you can afford it. That's what we want, right?
Well, I think so. I actually don't know if there's universal agreement on this, but it sounds like you and I agree, which is nice, because we don't always agree as people who've seen our conversations on here, or, you know, internally at SBI on our Slack channel, know that Kara and I don't always agree with each other. But I think here we are, in my view, absolutely, that every person, or at least as many people in Canada as possible, should have both affordable ownership options. And I would define affordable as being shelter costs of 30% of their income or below, and affordable rental options, again, at a cost of 30% of their income and below, and ideally as in many cities as possible. So I, you know, in my view, it's not about, you know, renting versus owning any more than it is about, you know, living in Guelph versus living in Winnipeg. It should be that people should have those options. As many people as possible should have those options. You know, the market can do a lot of that if we allow it, but it can't do all of it. And this is where there's a need for social housing, for co-ops, for not-for-profits, right? If you have somebody working part-time at minimum wage, they're never going to have the market's never going to create an affordable rental option for them. It's just not. The costs are too high. That's where it makes sense for government to come in with a combination of both, you know, building the homes, running the homes, working for not-for-profits, but also things like rental subsidies, you know, GST rebates and that kind of thing. But in my view, that's the promised land. It's, you know, I'd love for us to be able to get out of a conversation that's renters versus owners or investors versus first-time home buyers, and instead be in a conversation about how do we create enough options for everyone. And where I think you and I are in violent agreement is right now, first-time home buyers are being absolutely blocked out of this market, and we need to do a whole lot more for them.
Thanks, everyone, for watching and listening. And thanks so much to our producer, as always, Meredith Martin.
And if you have any burning economic or housing questions, or would like to see me do another Twitter poll, please feel free to reach out to us at missingmiddlepodcast@gmail.com.
And we'll see you next time.